You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Hi, I'm Rosie Perez, and I'm here today for Leonard Lopate. Given how expensive everything is and how little money people have, we're all trying to cut corners where we can, but maybe you should think again before you opt for cheap food, which may carry a really high price and be very dangerous for you as well. That's the topic of Brian Walsh's recent cover story for Time magazine. You can find a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. Brian Walsh is a staff writer at Time, and I am really glad that he came by today. Welcome, Brian.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well.
I want to just jump right into this. Is food cheaper these days than it used to be?
It really is. Right now, families spend about maybe 10% of their income on food, and back in the early 60s, for instance, it was as high as 18%, and that's a result of farmers getting more efficient, producing more food, driving down costs.
Wow. You also write that our food system uses 19% of fossil fuels, more than any other part of the economy. Isn't fuel expensive too? I mean, these days.
Yes, I mean it's definitely a big part of it. In fact, that's a concern we have when we look at that story about what the future of agriculture is going to be, because oil is a huge part of the way we farm now. It's in your fertilizer. It's in, obviously, it drives your tractors. It ships food all around. And if you remember, like last year, when there was a spike in food costs, that was partially due to the fact that oil was so expensive about a year and a half ago. And there's real concerns that, you know, people look ahead to the future. Oil is going to go back up. I mean, as soon as this recession's over, you're going to see more demand for oil from around the world. Everything runs on oil. And that's going to impact food as well. And we have to think, if the whole system is built really on what would keep, one of the things that keeps it cheap is its ability to use petroleum in that way for fertilizer, for everything else, you have to worry about, well, is that sustainable? I mean, what's going to happen when it costs twice or three times as much as it does now?
And the other thing that I was really interested in your article was that, I don't know if you hate corn or you just blame corn a lot. You know, when did we start growing corn at the expense of other crops?
Well, it's really been something that's fairly recently. It goes back to the early 70s, or actually really just post-World War II, when there's this effort to really intensify American agriculture and the idea just produce as much as possible and make sure you keep costs as low as possible, because that was the early 70s was one of the last times when you really saw, again, like a sustained rise in food costs. And that you know, causes political problems. Politicians don't like that. So the Department of Agriculture really pushed to try to intensify growth. And so you ended up producing lots and lots of corn. And there's nothing wrong with corn. Corn is great. Corn is all over the place. But because it's produced so cheaply, in part due to the fact that the government is willing to subsidize it, you end up having really an excess of it. And then it has to go into any number of things. If you go to the supermarket, as many as a quarter of the food products you look at will contain corn. It won't be actual corn on the cob. It might be soda, for instance. I mean, Coca-Cola high fructose corn syrup is what makes it sweet because it's cheaper than using sugar. It goes into, you know, the front. Like if you take a Big Mac extra value meal, you see corn that's in the meat, in the hamburger. Corn is in the french fries in terms of frying it. Corn is in the Coke. And so by keeping that cheap, you sort of leave food companies needing to use it. And so it ends up going in a lot of processed foods, and that's problematic because that's one of the things that I think really leads to the sort of unhealthy diet we have. And so it's not that corn is bad, necessarily. It is like the sort of basic step to this industrial system that we've created now.
It is corn, or corn syrup, I should say, part of the reason why there's such a high rise in obesity?
That's definitely one possibility. I mean, trying to figure out what's behind the rise in obesity just over the last few decades is something that keeps doctors and researchers busy. And there are so many possible options. I mean, maybe we exercise or move around less. Certainly we eat more, it seems. But I think that's actually one of the key, you identify the high fructose corn syrup is a key part of it. I mean, it's really interesting to look at how sodas have gotten bigger. You know, back 70s, maybe you got a can of Coke or a bottle of Coke that might be 8 ounces or 12 ounces at most. Now, if you look around, you see you get the big 20 ounce bottles of Coke. You know, you go to, again, McDonald's or a movie theater to get the gigantic cups. And that's because, again, partially because corn's so cheap, it's very cheap for them to add, you know, give you twice as much Coke and way more calories. You drink it, you don't actually get full. And that's especially a big problem for kids, I think, as well.
Right. Now, when you talk about sodas and you talk about Coke, you know, it's very addictive. Does corn syrup have any part in that, or is it just the caffeine?
I think it's probably more likely just the caffeine or the sugar, really. I mean, you know, with kids, I mean, it's just they like the sweet stuff. I think,
but isn't the corn syrup the sweet stuff?
Yeah, the corn syrup is the sweet stuff. I mean, you know, without that, there would be sugar and so forth. That would be more expensive. So then you get into the cost issue as well. I mean, you can get a lot of soda for so little amount of money, add a lot of calories, and then not even realize it.
Right. And you know, what are some of the hidden costs in cheap foods?
Well, there's certainly one thing we read about in the story is for the production of meat, and that's beef or pork or chicken. When it's done under the sort of intensified system that we have now, you need to use antibiotics both to keep them healthy and to help them grow faster. And, you know, you can, with a cow or with chickens, I mean, nowadays farmers can really grow them incredibly quickly, and that's one of the reasons why it's less expensive. I mean, the sooner you can get that chicken from egg to, you know, to the supermarket, the cheaper it is for you. But the problem is when you're using a lot of antibiotics like that, you promote the growth of resistant bacteria. I mean, every time you use an antibiotic drug, bacteria will react to it, and some eventually will begin to develop a resistance. And that's worrying because then you get a rise in infections in human beings eventually that can't be treated by antibiotics. And we're already seeing that. There are certain infections that used to be treated fairly easily. Now they'll keep you in the hospital longer. There are even some infections that really can't be treated by any antibiotics. So that has a cost that no one would really expect. I mean, it's hard to connect one to the other, but scientists are definitely, and the government actually is also worried about this. So that's one element.
I'm speaking with Brian Walsh, staff writer of Time Magazine, who wrote the cover story, Getting Real About the High Price of Cheap Food, for the last week's issue. You can look it up on our link on our show page at WNYC.org. You know, the government, like you said, helps pay for a lot of this, you know, subsidizing the fertilization of the corn and what have you. Why don't they do that for fresh fruits and vegetables?
Well, that's partially due to the fact that, you know, fruits and vegetables are grown in different parts of the country. And actually, back in the when this sort of subsidy system came into being, they had pushed, they didn't actually want that kind of support. You know, they were trying to protect their market to some degree. They were actually rejecting it. So the result is, I mean, you don't get enough support really for the kind of fruits and vegetables that would be for a healthier diet. I mean, this is part of this, the really overriding theme of the story, I think, is that, you know, we've created the system, and it's worked really well in many ways. I mean, it's good that the food is not that expensive. I mean, it's not that having more expensive food by itself is good. What we want is better food altogether. And if we created a system that maybe would subsidize fruits and vegetables, get them out, especially into the neighborhoods where they aren't. I mean, there are so many places, in New York City, for instance, where you don't have a supermarket. You know, you don't have fresh food. And so you end up being dependent on fast food or processed food. And so we should really, I think about that and say, well, how do we want to create a healthier America? And one of the ways to start with that is to change the way we produce our food.
I'm talking with Brian Wall, staff writer of Time Magazine. Callers, please, if you have any questions for Brian, please call us at 212-433-9692. That is 212-433-9692. I look forward to your calls. You know, when you talk about people who cannot afford good food, and I was listening to the news a couple of weeks ago, and they were saying there was the debate about organic versus non-organic, and they were saying there was basically no difference, and there was a lot of people that were, you know, begged to differ. You know, when I was growing up, you know, I was a child of welfare, and having good food was just not a reality. And the only time that I was privy to really good food was when I was down in Puerto Rico. You know, and my I have great not only sympathy but empathy for people who can't afford, you know, good food, let alone organic food. How do we change that? You know, how do we give that to them, you know, offer that to them in a viable way? Because people that I know that I grew up with, they get very defensive and they say, oh, people are fools for buying organic. And and they're just doing that as a defense because it's sad. What are your suggestions? And call us. If you have any suggestions, please call us.
Well, I guess one thing is that, especially when you're thinking just about your own health or your family's health, it's not incredibly important to pick organic versus conventional when it comes to health reasons. I mean, what's more important is to pick more fruits and vegetables. When it comes, the real benefit of organic, and it's, you know, you see different studies that come out different times that give you different solutions. But the real benefit of organic is that it's easier on the planet, that you have easier on the environment. But in terms of people, I mean, one way is to, for instance, and this has been floated, is to be able to use food stamps at farmers markets. I mean, you know, definitely costs are higher there, but that would be one way to open up a whole system of produce to people who don't usually have it. There are programs. I mean, I'm from outside Philadelphia, and Philadelphia has a very interesting program called the Food Trust, where they actually go and try to do mobile carts and stores that specifically try to serve fruits and vegetables in kind of neighborhoods where you don't have supermarkets. I know in New York City, for instance, I think they had the green cart system where, again, so same idea, having a food cart, but instead of having it just be grilled meats or be hot dogs, you know, again, serving fruits and vegetables, and you specifically have to go to the kind of areas that wouldn't have them. So there are sort of small programs like that can, I think, help people get access to the kind of food that they don't have right now.
I want to take a caller. Amy in Manhattan. Let's see. Hello, Amy?
Hi.
Hi. What is your question for Brian?
He was talking about the use of corn syrup in soft drinks, but there's another aspect, which is that from what I've read, your body doesn't really register calories that you take in liquids. So that if you drink something that with a lot of calories, you're not gonna compensate for it by eating less the rest of the day. Whereas if you eat a high calorie food, you are likely to eat less the rest of the day.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I mean, you know, there's really actually about a limit to how much food we can eat per year. I mean, it's just, you know, our stomachs have a limit to how much they can go. But you're absolutely right that you can get a lot of Coke or any kind of soda really. And get 200, 300, 400, 500 calories if you're talking about those really big containers and not realize it at all. And I think, again, that's particularly bad for kids because they're less likely to sort of realize that. They're more sensitive to sweetness. I mean, they're going to go for that more. And that's a real problem. I mean, you've seen schools begin to try to phase out vending machines for sodas, things like that. That's a great idea as well. I mean, and so I think that's definitely something to watch out for.
We have another caller. Thank you, Amy, so much for your call. We have another caller here. I would like to go to Ben in Harlem. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Rosie. I'm a big fan.
Thank you.
Even though you, I have a comment. I want to suggest that we can grow delicious fruit from trees in our city street trees.
Mm.
We can also encourage more community gardens. We have the proliferation of abandoned and blighted property as the economy goes down. Let's take that land and make it community gardens where we can grow delicious organic food.
Thank you for your call. Thank you, Ben.
It's interesting. I mean, you know, rooftop gardens are becoming popular, and I live in Brooklyn, and I see people doing that now. I mean, there's a lot of space out there that can be used. You can also there's actually even a company I know that's working on vertical towers that will have, you know, layer after layer of food growing for cities again. And this sort of goes back to the story, which is, you know, right now we have a very centralized system. We have, you know, just some parts of the country are creating food for us. It would be good to regionalize that, to have different parts of the country building food. That would be safer, for instance. You know, you'd be less vulnerable if something happens. And it would get people closer to it. I think one aspect of the problems with the way that we eat is because we become divorced from where our food comes from. Especially if you live in the city, you don't know what a farm is, don't know where it comes from. If you see more gardening, people begin to realize, okay, this is how the system works, and I can be part of it.
Right. I'm speaking with Brian Walsh, a Time Magazine staff writer who wrote the cover story about what cheap food is really costing us in last week's issue. You can read it if you haven't already. There's a link on our show page at WNYC.org. We'll have more after a break. And in the meantime, we'd love to hear from you. Thank you. The board is lighting up. I'm so happy that you guys are listening. And we would like to know whether you're willing to pay more for good food. So call us here at 212-433-9692. Later on in the show, none other than the godfather of independent film and modern black cinema, Melvin Van Peebles, fills us in on his latest film, which just opened last week on his 77th birthday. Plus, Please Explain is all about gut instincts. Where do they come from, and can you trust them? I'm Rosie Perez, in today for Leonard Lope. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC support comes from the Adelphi University Performing Arts Center. The season begins with pianist Ian Parker performing Beethoven, Chopin, Louis and Liszt, September 12th at 8, pre-show wine and cheese reception at 7. Individual and group tickets available now at 516-877-4000. Sony Pictures Classics, presenting It Might Get Loud. Davis Guggenheim's new film about rock legends Jimmy Page, The Edge, and Jack White, and their love affair with rock music and the electric guitar. Now playing. Epson, featuring the Epson Stylus NX515, a printer that is Wi-Fi enabled for multiple computers to share, compatible with high capacity ink cartridges, and capable of printing double-sided. More information at Epson.com.
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
You know about the Munchkins, the flying monkeys, and the witches, but the Land of Oz is stranger than you ever imagined. We'll discover why this American icon inspires countless filmmakers, musicians, and novelists, and serves as a metaphor for practically everything. The Wizard of Oz, next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
This weekend on 93.9 FM and AM 820.
Hi, I'm Rosie Perez, and I am sitting in for Leonard Lope. I am here with Brian Wall, staff writer of Time Magazine, who wrote the cover story, Getting Real About the High Price of Cheap Food, for last week's issue. You can look it up on our link page, at WNYC.org. Talking about the cost of food, the board is going crazy, and I think that's one of the main issues. I want to go to, is it Anita from Manhattan? Hello, Anita, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, and do you have a question?
Well, yes, do you think that with Obama in the White House and his growing organic food, that perhaps we will stop supporting the big agribusinesses and start supporting organic farming?
Well, I think it is interesting that you saw the First Lady, you saw Michelle Obama, start that organic garden. And that was actually, in the agricultural community, kind of controversial because people, see the White House is so important and what they do is so symbolic. In terms of his pick for the Secretary of Agriculture, it was Tom Vilsack. And he has, he comes from the Midwest. He has ties to mainstream agriculture, but he definitely, what I've heard, they seem to be a lot more open about this. They seem to be more interested in talking about it, certainly. But it's difficult. I mean, you have the food system as it is now is dominated by a few pretty big players, and they have a lot of influence in government. They have a lot of influence on both sides, Republican and Democrat. So to change that would be difficult. I mean, the Farm Bill came out a couple of years ago, and it's an incredibly complicated piece of legislation, and it has a lot of lobbyists. So to get change, and that's why I think a lot of people suggest, and we suggest at the end of the story, that a lot of the change is going to have to come from the bottom up, from consumers saying, like, we want different food, we want to change the way we food, and producers will respond to that, and they already are, actually, which is why organic, in a very broad way, is really the fastest growing part of the food market.
But it also could come from the bottom up through advocacy,
mm-hmm.
correct?
Yes.
Also, does the city of New York pay for the rooftop gardens? Do they subsidize it in any way?
I don't believe they do now. I think right now this is something that people are doing on their own if they have the rooftop space and they have interested, But you've seen community gardens around here. I was in San Francisco a while back, and or actually was in Oakland, and they have a really vibrant community gardening program there. And they bring people in, and again, that's another place where you have a hard time getting fresh food. Well, now you bring people in to make it themselves. They become invested in it, so they're not only eating better, but they're understanding the system better as well.
You know what I don't understand is that, with the welfare system and with food stamps, mm-hmm. well, now it's a food card, why does that not compensate for better food, for the price of better food? Mm-hmm. Are they considering that?
I think they are considering that. I mean, the reason why I suspect it didn't is simply because you know, the assumption was, well, we just want to get you as many calories as possible. I mean, if you're in that situation where you need help to supplement what you're buying, the most important part is just to try to get you as much food as possible. That was sort of the same mindset we had with farmers more generally. I mean, we just want to grow as many crops as possible, make sure we have an excess, and that's great. It's only recently that we're thinking, well, actually, look what this may have brought us. I mean, it created some environmental problems, and from a health perspective, we definitely don't seem very healthy in the way we eat. So I think it's rethinking it that way.
Do farmers markets accept food stamps?
They don't right now, but that's something that they really should be thinking of, and I hope they will change that.
I hope the listeners are listening and writing to Bloomberg and the president. But anyway, I want to talk about meat. Mm-hmm. In your article, you talked about the farming industry. Mm-hmm. And one thing that really was extremely disturbing was how they bunched the cows together, or how they bunched the pigs together, and the waste that is gathered from them, and how it's trickling down the Mississippi River and just polluting our waters and our environment and killing the fishing industry. Mm-hmm. But just on a soulful level, it's just so horrific. To the pictures in your article was just heartbreaking. Why are they still doing that?
Well, they're doing it because that's the way you make it less expensive. Again, I mean, you know, you it's just like any other business. I mean, if you get efficiencies of scale, you push them together, you grow them faster, you produce it more cheaply, and then all those outcomes you talk about, the fertilizer that goes to feed that goes to create the grain that feeds them. Or the waste, the manure, literally,
which destroys the soil. Right?
Which it actually can be used as fertilizer, but you know, it's if you just have a few animals in a farm, like farming before World War II, before you really saw this intensification, you often had a whole variety of things in the farm. You grew different crops, you rotated them to keep the soil fresh. You had animals, and then you could use that manure as fertilizer, actually, and it was a more organic, sustainable kind of fertilizer than the sort we use now. But now when you bunch thousands and thousands of them together, that's more manure than you can easily use. And then it can create, certainly if not a pollution problem, a real quality of life issue for the people who live near them. We talked to a woman who lives near a hog factory farm, and quite honestly, the smell can be pretty hard to take.
And how much, when you're talking about the hog farm, how much waste does a pig produce compared to a human being? And what are the repercussions that we are experiencing now?
Well, on a pound-for-pound basis, it kind of varies depending on the individual pig and, I guess, the person, too. But it's roughly maybe four times. So a pig that, you know, for every pound of a person or a pound of a pig, they produce four times as much. And that, you know, in a big concentrated pork-raising operation, that's a lot of manure to have to deal with. And often they're put in sort of open-air lagoons, is the term, and try to keep them separate from the land. But there's a risk you can have if there are storms. You can see an overflow. It could possibly leak as well. And again, yeah, it's just, you know, it's not a pleasant thing to live next to.
Can you tell us of any places that are doing things right? Like is it Nyman Ranch?
It's Nyman, actually.
Nyman.
Yeah.
From Brooklyn.
That's,
you know,
okay. I got it wrong the first five times I talked to him as well. He's an interesting guy. He is, you know, he moved to Bolinas, which is north of San Francisco, like more than 30 years ago, and just kind of got into farming. He was tutoring ranchers, and then they gave him cows in return, and got quite good at it. And, you know, he does it in a way that right now he's doing cows mostly. He does it in a way that's very sustainable. He just feeds them grass, whereas, you know, conventional cows will be raised on grass for about 6 months. Then they go into those feedlot operations, and then they're fed corn, which gets them fat faster. But also, you know, cows aren't meant to eat corn, so it causes them health problems. So he has a sustainable system. He can just move them around the grass, so they just eat the grass when it's there. He doesn't use any drugs, and he doesn't have to, because when they're not packed in a tight environment like that, or they're eating, you know, the normal diet for them, they are healthier. So he doesn't have to worry about that. So that's a really good way to look at it, I think. I mean, but the problem is that, you know, his costs are going to be higher than someone who does it conventionally, and certainly the meat he sells is going to be more expensive.
Right. Let's go to Julie in the Bronx. Hello, Julie. Julie, are you there?
Nice to hear you on the air, Rosie Perez.
Thank you, Julie.
Great to hear you. I have a question about agribusiness getting into the organic food business, that can begin to weaken organic standards in the United States, and it's very much counter to the local food movement as well, because, for instance, I was at Wegmans, and they had organic beef, and I thought, great, and then I read the label, and it was from Argentina. And also, I believe Dean Foods owns Horizon Milk, but I've read about the actual conditions of the cows that produce that milk, and it's really not in the spirit of what organic food's about, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Julie.
Sure. You're absolutely right. I mean, on one hand, the growth of organic, you know, you're getting, you know, big producers notice this and they jump into it. So you have, for instance, General Mills, which is a big food corporation, has now an organic arm and it's gotten connected to that. And definitely the organic standards, which is actually fairly recent, you know, they're sort of pushed towards making it easier for big producers to get into it. I mean, definitely they're looking to try to make it broader in terms of what qualifies as organic. And, you know, it's absolutely right what she did in terms of looking at the label, reading the label. And you can't just trust if it says organic, if it says natural, because those words, in a legal sense, don't mean a whole lot. So it helps if you read and see where it came from, make that judgment. And that's, again, where the local farmers markets are great, because then you can actually meet the people who make the food, talk to them if you're really interested in it, know where their food comes from, what they do, and make the judgment that way.
I want to go back to a caller, Cassandra, in Bushwick. She has a comment about the food stamps. Cassandra?
Yeah, I believe that the speaker said that farmers markets do not take food stamps, and I wanted to correct that not all of them do, but many of them do, like both of them in Bushwick, in Bed-Stuy, in Midwood, in Williamsburg, in Fort Greene, in East New York, that you can use food stamps there, and for every $5 you spend, you get $2 free, so it really is encouraging people on food stamps to use them. The other point was about introducing sustainable models that make this organic food more affordable for people, like supporting food co-ops. Like, Whole Foods has great organic food, but not everybody can afford it. And so, like, we're trying to start a food co-op here in Bushwick, which keeps the price down because it's run by members and you have lower overhead costs.
Thank you, Cassandra, and a shout out to Bushwick.
All right, thank you.
All right, I'm Rosie Perez, and I am here with Brian Wall, staff writer, Time Magazine, who wrote the cover story, Getting Real About the High Price of Cheap Food. Oh, yes, and I should mention, I am sitting in for Leonard Lopate. I want to go back to the livestock industry. Back in 1906, and you mentioned this in your article about Upton Sinclair's novel, The Jungle, it got all upset about meat production here in this country. And how are things worse? I assume they are worse. They are worse.
Well, I mean, in many ways, I wouldn't want to overdo it. Like, in many ways, they are a lot better. I mean, if you've that novel paints a pretty grim picture of meat production, some pretty scary stuff. And actually, that led to the creation of like the Food and Drug Administration and these other government bodies that are now there to inspect this system and make sure it's better. So, you know, that's better. But on the other hand, what's worse is simply that it has grown larger. And so the outcome in a sort of environmental level is more concerning, because you do have so many more animals being produced, and that carries with it its own burden. So I think that's the worry now. And then there is always going to be a food safety concern. And I think really, especially during the Bush administration, you saw across the board really trying to lessen regulations. I mean, being less forceful about pursuing problems with food safety. And that's being corrected now, actually. I mean, Congress is looking to try to amp up the food safety. The Food and Drug Administration now under President Obama is tightening some regulations. So in that way, I think things are getting better.
And also, there are the companies like Chipotle.
Mm-hmm.
They only use meat from these farms, mm-hmm. such as the Nyman.
Yeah, I mean, they. It's interesting with them, because I spoke to the founder, and he did it mostly because he thought it tasted better. You know, and that's something we haven't really even talked about. Really, is that a lot of people really believe that the system is not only does it turn out cheap food, but the food doesn't actually taste that great either. And, you know, so he wanted better ingredients, he wanted better meat, and then he found that the best way to do that was to go to the more organic, sustainable producers, because it tasted better. And then, you know, then they realized, well, there's also this great environmental benefit to it as well.
And hasn't his business increased?
Yes, I mean they've grown quite a bit. I mean they have over 900 stores now. They're doing pretty well, and they, you know, the cost issue is interesting because, you know, they have to pay for that more sustainable food, and so their food costs as a part of their overall budget is definitely higher than you know, their competitors. But so far, it's worked out well for them.
That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. I want to go to another caller. Forgive me, is it Ghana from Garrison? Hello.
I'm a teacher, and I teach in Croton. And I just want to say that I think the schools is really, they're really the place where you can make full societal change. If you teach kids how to grow food from, you know, kindergarten through 12th grade, you can wrap a lot of curriculum into that, and it should pan out into the rest of the environment. So there's a program with the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization where kids grow vegetables in schools or in community centers using earth boxes, and then they're hooked up with kids in other countries who are also using earth boxes to grow vegetables. And it's just, you know, taking off now, I think, in the last year or two, but it's really a tremendous opportunity for people to participate, and, you know, for schools to participate and for us to really change people's attitudes.
Thank you, Ghana. Thank you for your call.
Yeah, that's absolutely true in the sense that, again, if you educate kids, both in terms of getting them better food, but also educate them about where food comes from, they're going to make better consumer choices. I mean, right now it makes sense that people choose food mostly based on price because they don't really know where it's coming from. And kids are so vulnerable to the advertising system for fast food and for bad food, really. You know, I mean, that industry can spend billions in advertising, a lot of it directed to kids, which is way in excess of all these other programs we talk about. So anything you can do to try to balance that out is really worthwhile.
Yes. You know, when I went to college, I went on this date with this guy that I couldn't stand, but that I digress. I remember he packed a picnic lunch for us, and it was just full of fruits and everything. And I sat there, and it didn't even occur to me at that time, you know, at 18 years old, that you can have a wonderful lunch just comprised of fruit. And I think for Ghana, she is right. It does start, you know. And I think it goes right back to, I don't want to be accused as being an ultra-liberal socialist here, but I think that the government can do a lot more. I'm speaking with Brian Walsh today, and I'm Rosie Perez sitting in for Leonard Lope. And before we go, just one last thing that I want to really, really want to talk about is how can we really make a difference? You say from the bottom up, but can you give any specific examples? You say from the bottom up, you said that we can demand it from the people who are making this food, but how are other examples that, you know, people can change?
Well, definitely. I mean, consumer demand is going to be the biggest one. They say that you can vote on this three times a day with food. Every day you get three meals, and you can vote with your pocketbook in terms of the kind of food you're getting. Otherwise, you know, I mean, it's not often an issue in campaigns because it tends to be something that we think is for other parts of the country, maybe, or just for farmers. But I mean, that's something we should raise. I mean, I'd like to see politicians talking about this more, and I think they're going to, and I think you'll see, you know, I mean, the president has, obviously, there's something he talks about, and, you know, he, during the campaign, was accused of being, I guess, what, a liberal or elitist for liking arugula or choosing a healthier diet, and I think that's too bad. I mean, this shouldn't be a culture war. I mean, it doesn't matter if you are a Republican or a Democrat. I mean, good food is something that should be the right of everyone, and I think if we try to break that down, if we try to make it so we're not sort of at each other's throats over there, but realize, look, this is something that can benefit everyone. It can benefit farmers. I mean, we should be doing more to help farmers in many ways. I mean, the family farmer is hurting right now in America, and that is partly, I think, because we don't put enough emphasis on food. I mean, food is incredibly important. It's the thing that we all need. And so seeing a national conversation that recognizes that and helps them as well would be a great way to start, too.
Well, thank you, Brian, so much for sitting in here with me as my first guest. I was speaking to Brian Walsh, staff writer of Time Magazine, who wrote the cover story, Getting Real About the High Price of Cheap Food, for last week's issue. You can look it up on our link show page at WNYC.org. I'm Rosie Perez, sitting in for Leonard Lope, and I want to thank every single one who called in, even if we couldn't get to you today. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you so much.